Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Community Voices producer Jocelyn Robinson is back with another fascinating edition of Rediscovered Radio. And season two of WISO's Reinvention Stories began this week. We'll hear our first story. Later in the program, Bill Felker with Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac. Up first, Huber Heights has announced plans to seek an income tax increase on the November ballot. As WISO's Lewis Wallace reports, the city is predicting budget shortfalls of $2.3 million a year.
Huber Heights has a lot going on. On the one hand, a giant music venue is going up off I-70 that's expected to open by 2015. The $18 million for that project are coming from tax increment financing, a special fund built up from property taxes on other development projects. On the other hand, the city's down millions in revenue to pay for basic operations. Scott Fulkowski is Huber Heights' assistant city manager.
We've been using reserves for the past 5 to 6 years to provide the services we have out there today, and we've come to a crossroads.
He hopes the music center and a hotel and sports complex going up nearby will help dig Huber Heights out in the long run. But in the immediate future, the city could be looking at cuts. Voters in 2012 rejected an income tax levy, and a school levy was defeated in 2013. Lewis Wallace, WYSO.
Greene County Sheriff's Major Eric Spicer has retained a lawyer to challenge his recent termination. WISO's Wayne Baker reports that Spicer was relieved of his duties following an internal investigation related to the July 2013 police standoff with a Yellow Springs resident.
Spicer has been on paid administrative leave since the July 2013 officer-involved shooting that left Paul Lee Shank dead. The Ohio Attorney General's Bureau of Investigation released a report after the standoff indicating that Spicer led officers under his command to the wrong home instead of the Shank residence for a period of nearly 2 hours. Montgomery County Sheriff Phil Plummer's office investigated Spicer and released its findings late last week to Greene County Sheriff Gene Fisher. Fisher would not say if the report led to Spicer's termination.
Officially, Eric was released because he's an unclassified employee and serves at the will of the sheriff. Other than that, the advice of counsel is to not make any comments.
Spicer issued a written statement in which he says that he is proud of his record and is looking forward to serving in some capacity again. SWAT team member James Hughes was also investigated after the incident and was cleared of any wrongdoing. Wayne Baker, WYSO.
Cities across the country have been given a deadline extension to apply for federal money to support manufacturing. 10 federal agencies will distribute $1.3 billion to 12 designated manufacturing communities nationwide. Dayton, Cincinnati, Montgomery County, and the Dayton Development Coalition are all collaborating on a regional application. The federal program is called Investing in Manufacturing Communities Partnership. Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley welcomes the new deadline of April 14th.
When Cincinnati came on, we were already working on a smaller application that, you know, wasn't as strong, definitely not as strong without Cincinnati, which really helped us so we can get support letters from our manufacturers and folks, you know, and universities across the regions.
The regional approach is somewhat new for cities that may have seen each other as competition in the past.
We have a lot of connectivity with Cincinnati. We're going to be applying for aerospace manufacturing, and, you know, creating that supply chain up and down 75 is going to be key for Dayton.
Companies and city governments within the manufacturing communities that are chosen will then be able to apply for project-specific funds. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Politics Ohio with WYSO News Director Emily McCord and Under Construction with Lewis Wallace.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Governor Kasich released his midterm budget this week. His proposal includes income tax cuts for Ohioans and tax cuts targeted at low-income Ohioans. Karen Kassler with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau says it also addresses workforce development and education. And all of this comes as Governor Kasich faces re-election this fall.
Now, the tax cuts part is probably the one that gets the most attention. It's not only tax cuts, but it's tax increases. It's an 8.5% across-the-board income tax cut, and it's designed to bring the top rate down below 5%, to bring it down to 4.88%. And this would be specifically targeted toward that top tax rate because he feels that that will spur economic growth and create jobs. But everybody gets the income tax cut. It's paid for with an increase in two taxes, and there are two taxes that most polls have shown people don't have a big problem with seeing increased: the severance tax on big oil and natural gas drillers, and the cigarette tax. It would be raised by 60 cents a pack from $1.25 to $1.85.
You know, and we often talk about budgets as moral documents. What do we see about Kasich's priorities here when we're looking at it kind of from that bird's eye view?
Well, I think it's interesting to see some of the things that he has proposed with regard to helping people who are low income, helping people who have drug addiction, helping people who are dealing with a variety of issues. You know, it's interesting to see him focus on that, at least in part of this budget. But, you know, certainly other folks are going to look at this and say that this is just a blatant way to try to get votes during an election year by cutting income taxes. That way the governor and Republican lawmakers can say, we cut taxes for you. We've cut taxes. If this one goes through, the governor's tax cuts have amounted to almost 18% since he took office. So there's definitely two sides to this that you're going to hear about, I think, coming up in the campaign. The side of that this is a budget that's compassionate conservatism versus a budget that is definitely targeted toward the wealthy.
And we have Republicans that have, you know, kind of balked at this idea of the oil and gas severance tax, for example. Is there a risk for Kasich moving forward within his own party when it comes to the election season ahead?
Well, certainly the severance tax idea has been widely supported. Kasich's talked about his concern that if it doesn't go through, that maybe activists would come to the ballot and put it before voters, because voters have indicated that they want to see, especially these big oil and gas drillers who are coming into Ohio, they want to see them pay a higher severance tax. But you've got Republican lawmakers who say that they don't want to damage this industry that's just really starting up here in Ohio. So the struggle over the severance tax is very serious. The governor's tried to do a couple of things in this one. Ohio's severance tax would still be among the lowest in the country. He's exempting the smaller producers. He's exempting the R&D for about $8 million from the time that you dig the first well, so that there's a little bit of recoup of costs there. But this is a real continuing struggle. He really wants to see this happen. A lot of lawmakers don't.
What's the response from the Democrats over this?
Well, certainly the Democrats say that this budget review does not do anything to help the middle class. They've pointed out that they've got studies that show that the average top 1%er, if this tax cut goes through, would get about a $2,500 tax break. But the bottom fifth, the bottom 20%, would only get about a $2 tax break. So that's what you're going to hear a lot about from the Democrats. They want to also see the reinstitution of this homestead tax exemption for property owners. It's a property tax exemption for elderly and disabled homeowners. They want to see that come back. And so, you know, they're going to battle primarily on the tax front.
And what happens next with this?
Well, it's already being heard. It was the day after it was launched on the website, it went to the House Ways and Means Committee. It's going to be broken up a little bit throughout the legislature. Whether it goes through or not is really an issue. The governor has made some comments about how he wants to get whatever done, but he's on no real timeline. That almost sounds very confident, like he expects to be reelected and will deal with whatever he doesn't get done in this budget review in his next budget. But, you know, he's really kind of leaving it up to lawmakers and saying, these are my ideas, and now you do what you do, and we'll see what we can't work out. But I really think that severance tax, he got Medicaid expansion done when a lot of people didn't want it to happen. I really look at that severance tax as being something he really wants, and when he wants something, it seems that he finds a way to at least get some of it.
I've been speaking with Karen Kassler with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
No problem.
Welcome to Under Construction, WISO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. I'm Lewis Wallace. This week we're talking accountability. How are public funds for economic development spent, and how are they tracked? Dayton Daily News investigative reporter Lynn Hulsey recently found the Dayton Development Coalition isn't forthcoming with that information. The coalition, which is a nonprofit, funnels millions in government funds to local development projects. She says $93 million have gone through the organization since 2004. 60% of that, public money.
They make a lot of claims about having brought jobs and investment and payroll to the area. I mean, after all, that is the payoff that you get when you do economic development. What I discovered is that their numbers were exaggerated. They claim as wins jobs that don't exist, investment that doesn't exist, and payroll that doesn't exist. It may eventually, but we have plenty of examples over the years of companies that said they were going to bring a certain number of jobs and never did, or they shut down their operations. The other thing is the general lack of transparency. They would not release basic information, including their operating budget. And that's a key number because they use that number as their basis for making their claims of success.
And what reasons did they give for not sharing their operating budget?
They only answered via email. They simply made a statement, "We do not release our operating budget."
And the Dayton Development Coalition was involved with this effort to get a drone test site, a UAV test site in Ohio, which fell through. What's significant about that?
You know, it was touted as a really important designation, you know, that would bring jobs. And there's a lot of work being done here. We're an aerospace hub. The coalition was picked to manage the application for the status. They hired a consultant. They got about $3.6 million, I think, in state money to do the drone proposal as well as some other unmanned aerial system work. Part of it was to set up the UAS center in Springfield. And, you know, they say even though the feds did not pick Ohio, Indiana's proposal, that the work can still go on here. You know, they don't see it as that big of a loss. Critics say, well, why did you spend $1.5 million then if we didn't need it?
Is this issue fundamentally about transparency or about accountability? Because it seems that the Dayton Development Coalition isn't legally required to be transparent with some of this information that you've been seeking.
It's about transparency and accountability. You know, the coalition has been handed a lot of power by public entities and a lot of public money. So whenever you have public money involved, you're supposed to do the public's business. But I don't think that the idea is that even though you're a private nonprofit, you are freed from the expectation that the public will be able to see what you're doing with their money. Now that they are the Jobs Ohio West is their designation, they are who the jurisdictions must go to when they have a development opportunity. If they want to get any state incentives, they've got to go through Jobs Ohio West or Jobs Ohio directly. That's a lot of power.
That's Lynn Hulsey with the Dayton Daily News. Her full report about secrecy in the Dayton Development Coalition was posted March 1st. And this is Under Construction, WISO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. We dig underneath the physical and economic markers of growth to look at the human consequences. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Last week on WYSO, we began our second season of Reinvention Stories, profiles of Daytonians who are reinventing themselves and their communities. Last year, in Season 1, we heard stories from South Park, Belmont, Twin Towers, and Residence Park. This year, we'll visit Old North Dayton and Five Oaks, plus the western suburb of Trotwood. We'll find out how people are coping with ongoing changes in the local economy and learn about the dreams they have for themselves and their neighborhoods. First, we go to Old North Dayton, where the bridge at Kiowee Street is lined with national flags from the neighborhood's founding immigrant communities, Hungarian, Polish, German, and Lithuanian. In the last few months, a Turkish flag went up as well. WYSO producer Sarah Buckingham has this week's story.
Old North Dayton is home to the largest concentration of Ahiska Turkish people in the United States. Many are refugees from Russia, where they lived as stateless people after a series of displacements caused by war and prejudice. In 2004, Congress granted refugee status to 15,000 people. Islam Shahbandarov was one of them.
I didn't know anything about the United States before I came. So I just came because I understand that there is no future in the part of the world I live.
In September 2005, Shakhbandarov arrived in Abilene, Texas, where the U.S. State Department was resettling people. He spoke little English, and he had no money.
Okay, I was working in cookie factory. I was get paid $5.80 or something. But it was awesome because it was enough, because we never have any money before.
In those first few years in the U.S., Shakhbandarov moved from job to job and city to city, trying to find the right place. He got married, had a son, and eventually chose Dayton after visiting a friend who told him about the city's low home prices.
I cannot believe that in this country you can find the property for $10,000. You know, even in Russia, it's much, much, much expensive. How you can find it? And then I went to the internet and I start looking at the prices of real estate. It's incredibly low. And I liked the neighborhood. It wasn't bad, you know. It's not the perfect, but it's not the bad, you know. Five families with me moved here in 2007. Now we have around 400 families here. There was a lots of empty houses when we came here. Now we're kind of changed, reverted. It's much cleaner than it was before. It's very attractive.
One day, Shakhbandarov got a call from J.P. Morgan Chase. They needed a Turkish speaker to work with the growing Ahiska-Turkish community, so they offered him a job. He became a personal banker.
While I was working at the bank, one of my customers was trying to abuse me. He tried to bring some materials very offensive about Islam. 99% was false information.
The customer's pamphlet said that Muslims should be stopped from immigrating to the U.S., Shakhbandarov says this kind of confrontation happened a lot in Russia, and there, no one would come to his defense.
Here, people around me actually opposed to him.
Shakhbandarov's co-workers and the bank manager backed him up. The incident showed him there was an opportunity to open a dialogue. Because in Russia, he says, people in power, like a bank manager, were automatically against Ahiska Turks. Here, they're not, but some people still need to be won over.
Nobody knew who we are. Some say Russian, some say Ukrainian, some say Turks. Nobody knows exactly who we are and why we come here. At some point, I get involved somehow. I don't know, don't ask me how. I'm quite often ask myself, but I get involved in the community. And we became a community leader.
Shakhbandarov worked with city officials to launch the Welcome Dayton Plan, an initiative to attract immigrant groups to the city. And he became the executive director of the Ahiska Turkish American Community Center of Dayton. But he says being a community leader means long hours, keeping him away from home. And he has to face critics within his own community.
All their lives, they've been under the pressure. So they don't really trust much people. So it takes time.
There are still 50 to 60,000 Ahiska Turkish people living in Russia. And Shakhbandarov wants to help bring them to the U.S.,
This probably going to be the biggest things in my life I would do, and it's my dream. So I think we accomplish a lot, but at least for me it's not enough.
For WYSO, I'm Sarah Buckingham.
Co-producer for this story was filmmaker Eric Risher. To see their short film about Islam Shakhbandarov and the Ahiska Turkish community, visit WYSO.org. Major funding for the second season of Reinvention Stories comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with support from Wright State University, Celia Fund, and the Yellow Springs Community Foundation and Antioch College. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Now we hear another exciting edition of Rediscovered Radio, our series delving into the audio archives at WYSO. Today we'll hear voices from the effort to integrate the Gegner Barbershop in Yellow Springs on March 14, 1964. And for this story, Archives fellow Jocelyn Robinson has her feet in two worlds. She brings us 50-year-old news reports about the barbershop protests, yet she also has her own memories of being there as a little girl.
We shall overcome.
You're hearing audio recorded by WYSO News in September of 1963. It's Walter Anderson, Antioch College's first black faculty member, leading hundreds of villagers who'd marched through Yellow Springs to mourn four little girls killed in a Birmingham church bombing and to strengthen their resolve to integrate a downtown barbershop. In the weeks after, protests escalated in front of Lou Gegner's shop, the last holdout in a decades-long effort to end racial discrimination in the village. WYSO covered the demonstrations as they intensified.
All five demonstrators kept picketing, so Sheriff Bradley read the injunction.
If you would cut the pickets to four, there will not be any arrests made. However, if this is not done, I have no other alternative.
The local civil rights demonstrators sang We Shall Overcome, the battle hymn of the integration movement. The National Association for the Advancement of White People countered with God Bless America. When no one dropped out of the picket line, all five demonstrators were arrested. They were loaded into a Yellow Springs police car for the trip to the Greene County Jail in Xenia.
We shall overcome someday. We shall overcome someday.
For months, my own mother had been one of the picketers in front of the barbershop that continued to refuse haircuts to black men despite a court order. But on March 14, 1964, that's 50 years ago today, something happened that I will never forget. That day, Antioch students and students from nearby Central State and Wilberforce colleges, along with hundreds of villagers, gathered to demonstrate in front of the shop. My parents brought me and my younger sisters and brother downtown, too. I was 8 years old, and I remember locking arms, swaying, and singing along with the protesters. We don't have archival tape of that day, but our oral history project has recorded eyewitness accounts. Sterling Wright was a young teenager, and Bomani Moyenda was 10 years old. Here are Sterling, then Bomani, with their memories of that day.
So I remember getting up in the morning and my parents telling me, don't go downtown because there's going to be problems. But I was 13 at the time, and myself and a lot of our friends were going to go down there anyway out of curiosity.
But I remember my mother taking my sister and I down there that day and standing and watching, and the students linked arm in arm, you know, across the street. I wasn't exactly sure what was going on, but I knew it was about this white man who refused to serve black customers.
So as we approached the town, me and a few of my friends, we started talking, and we were very well aware of what was going on in the United States. The demonstrations, the freedom riders, the lynchings, we were very, very well aware, and were very shocked that that could happen here in our hometown.
To see that many people occupying downtown and tension that was in the air, you know, to sense that and to hear the singing and the shouts of the protesters, you know, it was really intense.
It was so intense that officers in riot gear used nightsticks and fire hoses to break up the demonstrators. Those of us watching from the sidewalk scattered and ran, blinded and choking as tear gas billowed through the crowd. Abandoning nonviolence, some protesters actively resisted arrest, and over 100 people were hauled off to jail. The years of insistent but peaceful protests ended up in a riot that was carried on the national evening news. The barber closed the shop that day, never to reopen, never to integrate. The movement marched on. That summer, volunteers from all over the country headed for Mississippi to open freedom schools and register black voters. And Congress passed the Civil Rights Act on July 2nd of 64, making integration the law of the land. To hear more historic audio and to see photographs from this critical moment in our history, visit WYSO.org. For Rediscovered Radio at WYSO, I'm Jocelyn Robinson.
Major support for Rediscovered Radio comes from the Ohio Humanities Council and the Greene County Public Library.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fourth week of early spring. At one point in the middle of February, the big ficus tree that I bought last year for the greenhouse started losing its leaves, and the shedding was steady, and it unnerved me. No matter what I did, the leaf fall continued, and every morning the tree's branches looked emptier and emptier. There was nothing I could do to halt the sudden collapse of its foliage. Part of my unease was that the indoor plants I keep protected in the greenhouse are allies of a sort, a landscape apart. And for me, they are defenses against something I can't really name. And how many other partners do I gather around for security? Keepsakes, old letters, favorite pieces of clothing, books, photographs, even comfort foods. In so many ways, I am allied with the objects around me. They are all fragments of the barrier I have constructed in order to create my identity. A mosaic insulation of spirit and an illusion of power and order, connection, caring, beauty, and meaning. And I know that all this whole structure of alliances and bonds is a fantasy. And I know it will collapse if something goes awry. Still, now that spring is so close, I'm less dismayed by sick trees and my lack of control. My moods are as fickle as foliage and are always reconfigured and reassured by a few pussy willows, some blossoming snowdrops, and a warming wind. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fifth week of early spring. In the meantime, hold your allies, your plants and animals and people, hold them close. Thursday noons, between March 20th and April 24th, I will be the moderator of a seminar at the University of Dayton entitled The Inner Landscape. And these will be discussions about the almanac readings on WISO. For more information, call the Special Programs Office at the University of Dayton, 937-229-2605.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all our guests. Up next, the Book Nook.